Greetings, nerds. This is Santa Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Polk. How are you doing tonight, Will?
Doing very well, sir. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good.
That's good. That's good.
April is, like, the most disgusting month of the year, so...
Wow.
In Alaska.
Oh.
It's dirty. It's just so dirty outside. It's gross.
Is it just all like the snow melt and like all the stuff packed up for months, or what? I mean, what makes it so?
It's not like the snow melts and then suddenly green appears.
Well, it's yeah.
And then there's just dirt everywhere. So
yeah.
It's everyone's least favorite month in this in this state.
Yeah, sure. I hear you. I hear you. Yeah, we get the similar thing here in North Carolina with the pollen. You know, it's beautiful to see everything blooming, but on the other hand, it's just like this green film that like permeates everything for about a month. It's just like hard. Yeah, it's just brutal.
The only bit of news that we have to discuss tonight is just the Joker trailer that we both watched. So what did you think about this trailer?
So I felt like it was an extension of the first film, quite honestly. As far, I mean, I really enjoyed it. And I will say that I've only watched Joker one time. Watched it in the theater and I was like, that was an experience and I really enjoyed that experience and I don't need to experience it again. Not because it was bad. It was just like, I just wanted to just bask in how fantastic the film that was. But watching the trailer, I liked it. The cinematography was wonderful. The fact that it's a musical, this doesn't seem there's going to be an original song. Looks like there's going to be a lot of covers, but we got that element, you know, and of course the big similar beats that we had from the first film, with whether or not all this is going on in Arthur's head, or you know, combination of in his head and in the real world, those things that were at play. But you know, the title really, you know, Joker Folie à Deux. I mean, madness for two, you know, rough translation. It was all there.
Right. Yeah, I've seen the Joker movie twice.
Okay.
For some reason, I ended up watching it with my parents.
Okay.
After I saw it in theaters. But it's also a movie it's not even like to bask in the glory or whatever you just said about having watched it one time. It's just a really hard, like, it's not a happy movie. It's a well-crafted movie, but at the same time, it's not a story. It's like, oh, let me go and rewatch that.
Yeah. No. Yeah, as well as it's best. Yeah. Just like, it was an experience and I saw it. I enjoyed, I thought it was a well put together film, but right.
And it's not a story you want to return to again and again for, but at the same time, watching the trailer, first of all, it's just a really good trailer because you see a lot, you don't hear a lot, and it's just like, yeah, okay. We're back here. We're not going to get told that same story, but it's a continuation and it's going to be, they seem to have kept a lot of the elements, the cinematography, of course, same director. I think it's going to be probably on par, but we'll see. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm not looking forward to any more trailers. This was more than enough.
Yeah.
But at the same time, knowing what I thought about the first one, I'm also kind of like, okay, I'm looking forward to it, but I'm also just like, I don't like, it's a very different eagerness than when like there's something that I have rewatched a few times and it's like, okay, I can't wait for the sequel. So
yeah. It's sort of like, Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Yeah, I mean, it's a film that I'm anticipating, but the anticipation is different as far as in the comic book genre than say something like, Deadpool, which is coming out this summer.
Well, that's a good comparison because we've talked about our experiences with Deadpool, and they're about on par with Joker, where both Deadpool 1 and 2, like I remember having a blast, but for some reason I've never rewatched Deadpool 2. However, I am looking forward to the third one, but I'm looking forward just because I know I'm going to have an awesome time. When with the Joker 2, I'm just like, I don't know if I'm going to have an awesome time, but I think it's going to be a well put together movie. It's so different.
For
Oh my
sure,
God.
for sure. But Lady Gaga, as far as her take on Harley Quinn, and it seems like whether or not she is also a patient or was a psychiatrist and then became a patient in Arkham. I mean, how they meet and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm really interested in seeing how that all goes, and then also just the fact that she also is like Joaquin doing method acting, and also seeing her portray this character, and just like you said, it's just an extension of what we saw with Arthur in the first film, and just sort of the consequences of what we saw at the very end of that film. I mean, that end of the first film, which Gotham is going nuts and all the things that are happening there. I mean, that's the thing about that movie. I mean, it did leave an impression that even to this day, I still remember like all the things that happened in it, even though I've only watched it once. But
So my theory is kind of based on the very last scene in the trailer. There, she's talking to him through the guarded windows, like a somebody who's visiting an inmate would do, right? And I wonder if this whole thing is actually told through her eyes, and she maybe was. Like during at the time of the first movie occurred, was a nurse or whatever, a psychiatrist in Arkham. But then, because of what happened, and why he's now locked up in Arkham, she like he's glorified to an extent. And so she becomes one of those obsessed people who like, you know, how there's those people who end up like the fame of being a criminal will suddenly, oh, I want to have your baby. I'm going to write you letters and we're going to get married while you're still inside. Like she does that. And then I wonder if she does something else on the outside that makes her end up on the inside. Like, and the delusion is this love that she has for him. So.
I think that that's a very good theory, and especially given the scene where she does trigger warning, she does put the she imitates his action with putting I can't remember the exact wording that she says in the trailer, but with the suicide look, putting a gun to his head and stuff. So yeah, and to your point about him influencing her, and I guess that would be consistent with their madness of love as far as Joker and Harley Quinn anyway. So yeah.
So, well, we'll see. But again, like, see, this is what like it can be a good trailer, but I'm like, when we talk about these things, my head starts spinning, and then if I go into that movie and I'm but I got 6 months to forget all about this conversation completely. So,
Exactly.
yeah, exactly. And that will come out in October. So,
Number four.
all right. That brings us to Shogun Episode 8, The Abyss of Life. Torinaga's defeated clan moves to Edo. Blackthorn must decide who he fights for. Will, what are your overall thoughts about this episode?
Overall thoughts about this episode. It was one where I haven't had an emotional reaction to an episode like I did watching this one with Hiramatsu, his actions with Carrie when he did the seppuku And yeah, since probably like Last of Us or maybe Oppenheimer, as far as this, like, where I was just like, damn, I really did like just fall out of my chair from the incident there. But also, it was, this episode was really good. We talked a lot last week about Blackthorn and Mariko and whether or not things were getting stagnant there with their story. We did get more of some things moving, progressed with him and seeing how things are, you know, with Blackthorn in Japan, really, you know, and sort of he gets what he wants as far as finally getting to encounter his men. So there's good, you know, we got progression there. And yeah, I just really thought that this was probably my favorite episode to date of the series.
Very good. This episode should have been called Loyalty. So
yeah,
just yeah. Gonna like,
yeah, I agree.
Come on, I don't know what the abyss of life. I get it. You start with a death, you end with a death. Okay. So because you've already brought it up, we can jump to that last scene.
Yeah.
So you fell out of your chair.
Well, it's so, and the reason why I say that is I always thought that I had a feeling that he was going to die. But I thought it would be in a situation where either when he got, you know, dispatched to Osaka or in the battle at the end. But how it all came about, and I love the way that they had set this whole thing up with his death about whether or not he was in on Torunaga's plans. And you know, at the end of the day, we did find out that he wasn't on the plan, but I think Torunaga was anticipating to go one way, but Hiramatsu took it in a different way to still help shake Torunaga out of his, you know, to basically, you know, show how convinced and how loyal he is to his feudal lord. And so I just really thought that the way that all sort of just went down was just very effective. And it was one of those characters I just really, even though we haven't talked much about him here on the podcast, just watching the show, he's been one that I've really enjoyed throughout the series.
So wait, so yeah. You're saying that he wasn't on the plan to make it look like Torunaga's been defeated. But he wasn't in on the plan that to like really drive that point home, you're going to kill yourself.
I think he basically took the place, because with the way that things set up, everybody was defeated. But then, you know, we had the three generals that when they were going to Torunaga's son's funeral, they were in their armor. And then, of course, whenever the council does get together, of the vassals get together there at the end, of course, they were all in protest of Torunaga wanting to surrender. And so I think his plan was, you know, for the three of them to, like, commit seppuku. But, you know, and, of course, word would get back to Ishido and Lady Ochiba and Onosaka to, like, you know, yeah, he's really defeated. He's really done. He really is going to come here, accept the impeachment, etc. But I think Hiramatsu was like, no, for this to really, really, really work, it was a game, you know, I've got to make the ultimate sacrifice for my best friend.
Okay, so no, he wasn't in on that. Like, that wasn't part of Torunaga's plan. Hiramatsu called an audible and was like, no, I need to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I honestly, when you explain it like that, yeah, I that would make somewhat more sense. I still don't know where that leaves me with Torunaga, just because he still allowed it to happen, even though it wasn't part of his plan. So, like, on one hand, you can be like, yeah, Torunaga, great strategist here, like, clearly has everything under control. And then on, but then when, if he was not a part of the plan, then it's just like, no, that just happened because his right-hand man, like, called an audible and actually got the job done.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it's still just like I really enjoy this episode. It definitely is up there in terms, like, one of the better episodes of the show so far. I question if it's my favorite just because of the Lady Ochiba episode. Two episodes back was really done well. I was not emotionally, like, taken aback by what happened. Just because at the end of the day, I know Torunaga is going to win. So I'm watching the episode just being like, all right. I really like this episode, though, in comparison to last week, because it actually felt like people were doing things other than just waiting around. Choices were being, loyalties were being tested. Choices were being made. Yabushige and Blackthorn had scenes together, and like not just like, I'm going to teach you how to fight on the beach. No. Actual scenes, calling each other shit faces, but loyal shit faces. Like, come on, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But in terms of that final scene, it didn't, like, I don't know. It makes me question like, if I still like Torunaga, or if I've kind of lost respect for him as a character, because I'm like, dude, you just keep fucking up here, but okay.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I get it. But to your point, like, that wasn't even part of his plan.
Yeah. I think it was part of the plan. And I think Hiramatsu was a part of it. But, you know, I don't think, for example, Torunaga didn't anticipate his son, Nagagato, to, like, go off and try to kill his half-brother. You know?
Definitely not part of his plan, but he, in the long run, it afforded him time.
It gave him time. Yeah. And even the elders, all the vassals, when they were sitting around talking about him, Torunaga's son, it was like, yeah, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you know, they were like, you know, like, for example, Yabushige was just like, when they were on the beginning of the episode, when they're like on the march to Ito, he was like, You know, this is the guy, you know, it'd been better off for him. You know, he dies on a rock instead of, you know, he'd been better off just getting boiled to death in my pit, you know. so his recklessness was, you know, bought Torunaga some time. And I think, you know, Torunaga, again, was, you know, wanting to use, as I mentioned before, I think he, you know, his plan was to go one way. And I think, you know, it was so convincing to just about everyone except for Lady Jen and Hiramatsu. And then, of course, Mariko figured it out, you know, whenever she and Torunaga were talking there at the end. But to everyone else, I mean, Blackthorn, you know, all the other vassals, I mean, they all bought into the ruse that what Torunaga had given up.
Right. So are you saying that the ruse started last week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He definitely did not do as good of a job last week as he did this week. Because last week, it didn't feel like he was defeated. It felt like he legitimately did not know what to do.
Like, Yeah, well, I think that was part of the ruse.
Did not know what to do.
Yeah, I think that was part of the ruse, and this was carried but forward.
I don't know if that was a part of the ruse, because him not knowing what to do wasn't buying him time.
Mm. True.
I see. That's where I question you calling that a part of the ruse, because it to me is no. He legitimately did not know what to do. Then he got afforded because one of his sons, not his only son, manages to get himself killed. And then, well, the grief period. And then I think during that process, he realizes, okay, well, I gotta play dumb. I gotta play dead, essentially, here.
Yeah, yeah.
And see where that gets me.
Yeah, I think it helped. I mean, I think the ruse. I think the plan was started then, especially when you think about last week's episode with the plans. You know, whenever he and Lady Jen were talking about the stick of time when she was.
Yeah, I know.
Advocating for thinking with things in Ito for her.
Right.
Her world. The plan was there, but I think it just really, whenever you look at it in its totality with the events of this week, I don't know if it wasn't so much that he didn't know what he was doing. It's just it because I think Lady Jen figures it out then.
Well,
this just confirms that this was his long-term plan. But then there were some ball cards that happened that he didn't anticipate.
Okay. If Lady Jin, if we're saying that just because Lady Jin says, I know you have a plan, that means that she's figured out the plan. Which I don't technically think it does. Then that means for a majority of this episode, everybody else has figured out the plan too. Nope, because only until the end, when people start questioning, is like, no, are you really like, we're really like, this is the plan to actually surrender? Because everyone, like Blackthorne's the only one who's like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, I think
like
the fact that his other generals were in protest, I mean, wearing the armor and stuff, that was an act of defiance, because they really thought that he was defeated.
Okay.
So I think
I'm not going to continue on my point, but
go ahead.
Plan did Merritt, I'm still questioning, like, I'm not going to get into semantics about who knew about the plan, what was the plan, because honestly, I don't even really understand the plan. Like, the plan this episode was to play dead. I totally understand that plan, but right. When we're saying plan, that's such a general word. Like, what is the plan here? Like, you have time, you play dead, and then what? Like, and at the end, I have no idea when Mariko was brought into the fold or what she figured out. Because all I know is that there's that conversation at the end. It's like, well, now you do your part, or are you ready to do your part? And she says, yes, she is. So there's been conversations that we're not witness to.
After what happens with Hiramatsu, and she sees how he reacted to it, and that's, you know, just, I think it was one of those subtext things that she was reading between the lines that, oh, I see where he's coming from now. Prior to that, she was also like, the fact that here, you know, that he's not actually surrendering, that he is using this biding his time to amass his forces so he can, that they can do the Crimson Sky.
Right.
And, you know, so Hiramatsu, you know, Nagagato's death was just an unfortunate happy accident.
Right, we know.
Yeah, and then when Toranaga's in the courtyard there, it's like, you know, I've got this chance now. Hopefully he's thinking I'm not going to squander this, because I've lost two two key people in my life, and they bought me time.
What did you think about the tea scene?
Yeah, the tea scene was one that I'm glad they finally got some resolution to their situation. I don't know if it was resolution or just acknowledgement, but it just like it just hammers home the point why Butaro is just he's just trash. I guess, you know, he's like,
why is he trash?
Well, because all this time he was just like, I'm not going to, you know, he's like, I'm not going to let you die. And then now all of a sudden, because he, again, going back to the point about whether or not, you know, who's all on the plan or not, really believing that Torunaga's given up, he's like, okay, let's both commit suicide. And we, you know, so that we don't like.
Well, they go out on their own terms. Yeah. As man and wife. So
as man and wife.
I guess I don't understand why that would make him trash, though.
Because all this time, she, you know, because she didn't allow her to have the honorable death that she should have gotten with the rest of her family.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
But, I mean.
So, I mean, I just think he's you know, he's just jerking her around again, just as far as their relationship, as far as his power, you know, abusing his role in their relationship again.
Okay. So here are my thoughts about Bentaro, and I know it's very opposite of you, and probably a lot of other viewers. I just, for some reason, I just feel as though, for as good as the writing is on this show, they are not doing a good job with the ensemble. Because I think that we are shown only certain things from Bentaro, but they don't add up. And it doesn't, like, this whole dynamic. And so this scene itself, it's like, yeah, good on Mariko. She chooses to live. And she says F you to her husband, who we've seen do some abusive stuff. I still don't agree that it was abuse for him to like deny, like to say, no, you need to live, because he clearly loves her to some extent, like abuse or no abuse. He even says at the beginning of this scene, like, I remember when we first got married, because there was a period of time before anything happened with her father where they were together and they were creating this family and there were feelings. Now, she has changed, and he, I think, still holds on to that. And I still don't really, it's still not clear to me exactly what his intent was for not allowing her the honorable death, unless it's just like, that's my wife, I'm in love with her, how can I allow her to die? Like, why would I do such a thing? But even though it brings shame to him, like we talked about this at length, like a few weeks ago. Yeah. So I just, and where I'm coming about the writers and everything, it's just like, we honestly don't know how abusive he has been, because we've seen one scene of it. And I'm not excusing behavior, but I do want to like add in some context. He was really drunk.
Yeah.
And that's why he tells Blackthorn in that, at the end of that scene, like the sake, like that got to him. And he realized his wife was sleeping around on him. Granted, she thought he was dead, but still she did start an affair. And also, like, he's been in the village and observing them. Like, it's not just sex. It's an emotional affair. So he, like, had other aggressions going on then. So I feel like we are supposed to believe that he's a true villain, because he's the person who's preventing Mariko and Blackthorn to be together. But they are not doing enough in terms of consistency, because he's the one who's always like told her, no, you have to live. And then even in this moment, he's just like, I'm going to make tea for you. Like, we're still together. Like I want to make this work. But at the same time, I understand why Mariko says what she says, even though that's a little bit inconsistent for me, because I'm like, girl, you've been begging for death for years and you're not going to take it. Like, what? But anyway, so that's just my hot take on that dynamic. But yeah, we shall see. I mean, Mariko's now on a boat with Blackthorn and Yabushige, and I have no idea where Bentaro is. So, yeah. What else happened?
Well, Blackthorn finally got to, he finally got his wish, and he was reunited with his crew. And I really liked the way that scene sort of played out, especially in the context of earlier in the episode when Father Miller, I can't remember, was back. And of course, Blackthorn was released from his obligations of Toranaga, but then, there was that very cutting remark from the father about, whenever you reunite with your folks, are you going to be wearing your clothes? Right, you're gonna be wearing that outfit, and then when he finally does see his folks in the neighborhood there, and to see it, it was that real to me when I was watching that scene. It was that realization that Blackthorn had that he has, we've seen him, and they've shown this. He's gotten better about learning some Japanese phrases, and he's wearing traditional clothes, and just his whole manner, he's figuring out like how to navigate this country. And then, you see his former crewmates, and they're basically acting like the drunken barbarian that the Japanese initially thought Blackthorn was, not necessarily drunken, but just a, lower couth individual. And it just really showed his reaction to his former crewmate. Really just to me showed the how Blackthorn has changed in his time there in Japan. So I thought that I really liked the way that whole scene sort of displayed itself out, and especially even down to like the whole cleanliness thing that thought about earlier in the episode versus like now how clean Blackthorn is now compared to the other Europeans. It was just like really well done, I thought.
Yeah, I think that was a good scene too, just because in terms of he has been so desperate to get his crew because he feels responsible for them. And then when he encounters them, there's a resentment there and a divide there. And it's not the same crew that he left. In a way, they're not the same and he's not the same. And because they've had different experiences. And I think that scene could have played out so many different ways. Going into it, I was like, oh, okay, so I bet this is going to happen in that moment and this. And it didn't go exactly the way I expected, just because I wasn't surprised that the men like were mad. I don't even know if it's a result of how submersion, how much being in the position that he is in Japan, that Blackthorn has changed, but it was just a good reality check. Because I think that there's still something about him. Like, I like that line about how I don't belong to England. I don't belong here. Like, I'm kind of like a nomad at this point. So,
I like that too.
He really is. Like, there's something, which then that just rings true to what his crew member said. Like, you did this for yourself. So it's kind of like loyalty, is Blackthorn ever been loyal to anyone? Like, yeah. if that's true, like, this was a result of his actions for his own greed. So
yeah. That's a very good point. And to your point, why this Lippincher should have been titled loyalty, because there were so many loyalty tests and this displays of loyal or disloyal behavior among all these characters this episode. And thinking of, and it really gets to like the other pairing that you mentioned earlier, as far as Blackthorn and Yabushige and the, you know, the buddy show, this the spinoff that we need with these two characters, because we get, you know, Blackthorn, like, since he was cut loose from Toranaga, he was like, okay, I'll cast my flag on to Yabushige now. And Yabushige is sort of like, okay, okay, shit face, we'll figure out what we're going to do here. And
first denies him.
And he denies him. Yeah. He denies him. But also, I think, you know, it goes back all the way back to the very first episode as far as their pairing and how they're kind of mirror images of each other, because they're both like gaming the system or gaming the events to try to achieve their ends. And so maybe that's why at the end of the day they, you know, even they're sort of kindred spirits in that regard, but also just the bonding that they had on that cliff when Blackthorn saved Yabushige. Maybe there's this kind of weird like feeling of indebtedness or something.
He says it in this episode what it was. He says, I saw that you were a man who's willing to control his own fate.
Yeah.
And then my argument is, no. I remember that scene very, very well because it's my favorite scene in the first episode. And you did not understand why Yabushige was going to kill himself rather than let the sea take him. Rodriguez had to explain it to you. So let's not forget. Rodriguez had to do some explaining, and then you were like, oh, I understand now about why he did that. I would do something like that too. And then he kept it in the back of his mind to use in that moment, and it was good. Like it makes sense. I don't know if they're gaming the system. It's more that these two people they want to control fate. They don't want to blindly follow someone and not have any control over whether, like, I'm going to live or die. Like, no, I want some control here. So loyalty be damned. They're really good together. So I'm glad that we're going to probably have more scenes of them together moving forward. Anything else you want to talk about that happened in this episode?
I know I brought up Lady Jen and the father, and I just thought it was just funny of Toranaga as far as planning his, you know, future Ito, that he both willed them land next to each other, so the brothel and the church have to work together. Their next door neighbors. I thought that was just a funny moment. Whenever I did laugh out loud whenever that scene happened. And then of course, I guess, back in Osaka, we have, the consolidation of power there with, Shido and Lady Ochiba, where he's trying to, where he wants to marry her. And so, all these things are just really, like I said, I think to your point, where last week's episode, could be argued, didn't move so many things forward. I think this one definitely moved a lot of the pieces forward for the penultimate episode next week.
Do you think we're getting a second season?
No, I don't think so. I think everything's going to get wrapped up.
Good. Because I know that there's been some questions about that.
It's my understanding that this is the one-off. This is a limited series and everything gets wrapped up.
Yep. All right, well, that brings us to Three Body Problem, Episode 5, Judgment Day. As threat level rise, a secret mission to retrieve enemy intel ventures into dangerous territory. An ominous message reaches Earth. All right. So Panama, this episode, Judgment Day / What Happened in Panama. That's what we shall call this episode.
Yeah.
Those damn microfibers. I literally was like, holy fuck, that's what they were doing. Cause this whole episode, you're watching Raj and Augie in Panama working for Wade on a project, and you know she does nanofibers. But for some reason I was not like, I didn't understand. I was like, what is she building? And then they just, it was straight out of a horror movie. Yeah. I did scream mainly because there were parts where you're like, there are kids. They are showing us kids. I don't want to see a kid like literally split into a million little pieces here. No. And then they cut away and they only showed us adults.
Right. And the kid's foot. But, you know, I think that Augie saw it later.
The aftermath of a shoe of a foot. But you don't actually see the kid, which, thank God, I did not need to see that. But it was a very well done sequence. It went on a little bit too long. But you definitely got the horror element of what happened, which is good. That's what they wanted, considering Augie's distraughtness since Panama. But majority of this episode is about the lead up and the execution of that whole sequence. So what was going through your mind during that?
Same. I mean, whenever I realized, because I was like you, I was like, okay, what's okay, you're getting her work on again, and what's the purpose of these, not, you know, because, you know, we talked about this even last week, and as far as why the scientists are all committing suicide and everything, and what's the ultimate goal that the Santi were trying to do here, or Evans and Evans as well as their emissary. But I mean you said it all. I mean, whenever it happened, I was like, holy fuck. I was like wow. It was hard to watch, especially with the little kids at the beginning. It was. And it was a dramatic effect, and it was very effective. I mean, but I think to this point of the series, because when I started with this episode at first, I was kind of, I will say it was good and things were picking up, but I was kind of like, where are we going here? Why would we call it? Yeah. And then that happened. And then it just, everything from that was just like, whoa. So.
Yeah, see, I think I got a bit more of that in the next episode, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
But this episode, I was surprised because we start off with the aftermath of the raid and when Jay in present day being caught and by Wade and held for questioning, even though she legally hasn't done anything.
Yeah, exactly.
The sequence of this all is very questionable.
Yeah.
But you start to see some of the interrogations that occurs, and Clarence, who does the interrogation, and Clarence asks the questions that we're all asking. It's like, okay, we all know Evans read Little Red Riding Hood. And the Santi want nothing to do with us anymore because we're liars, okay? Right. And then the raid happens. So why did they let that happen? And then this happens after Augie like restarts her projects, and there is no countdown clock. Like, the Santi are clearly no longer protecting anyone. Like, they're not here for protecting anyone, because again, we're all liars and we're all blugs, as the message reads at the end of this episode. So it's very much that loss of trust. But Wenji is still persistent. Like, it's Wenji is in this weird situation where I'm like, I don't know what your play is at this point. Like, and get into it later towards, I think it happens in episode 6, but, because they do judgment, they destroy Judgment Day to get intel, of all of Evan's recordings of the conversations he's had with the Santi. Right. And then Wade gives, like, let's Wenji listen in on those, like, the highlights, which includes the moment where he inadvertently, like, made them lose all faith in us.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, this was like, yeah, I mean, I know this, you're right. I mean, this episode really got into the, you know, the gathering of the intelligence. And really, as far as her play, I mean, what, you know, one of the things that, you know, we wondered about before was whether or not Evans was indeed Vera's father. And we did get confirmation that he was at least a biological father. And that was about the extent of it.
Still does not make any sense to me, but okay.
Well, I mean, I guess. And I guess we learn later, well, in episode 6 about Vera learning about who I assume she learns that Evans is her father at that point. I don't know, but at least we know that Vera does discover their correspondence with one another, Evans and Wenji. So, yeah, I mean, it was the other thing that this episode, like I said, I felt, I guess it was a good Augie episode in the sense that we finally get, she's finally getting to do some stuff as far as more than just like seeing this countdown clock, how she fits into the overall bigger plot to, you know, get the Santi. And then the other thing I thought that stood out was, I don't know if it stood out, but it was just like, you know, it's starting to give Will more things to do other than just pining away for Jen. because, you know, Jack leaves his estate to Will, and as the story unfolds in the subsequent episode, we see him utilizing some of those resources for the plan that they come up with. So, and then of course the bigger thing is, you know, Wade and Jen putting on the headsets and learning more about the AI that they sent, and also really getting to the core about why the Santi wanted to, basically they're killing all these scientists to, like, because Earth, you know, it took the Santi millions of years to get to the development, whereas Earth, you know, Earthlings were able to do all these scientific advancements faster than the Santi. So ultimately the Santi was like, y'all are going to overtake us. So we're going to, like, do what we need to do to make sure we stay on, you know, that we remain in control here. So, but we can squash you bugs before you squash us.
Right, which I think we kind of already knew, though. Like, the whole, even though it wasn't so much a question of why for me, it was more of like how. Mm-hmm. Like, how is this happening? And then they explain it with the proton. And that's something that we kind of exchanged a brief conversation about this weekend, where it's like, the good thing about this show is you get a lot of questions, yeah, and it's so nice to have them all immediately answered.
Yeah.
And then new questions come up, or additional follow-up questions, if you will, come up, especially with how we're pairing this show with the in blocks of two. This show might drive me crazy if we were watching one episode at a time, not gonna lie.
It would
be very drawn out.
I think the two page is too much to binge, but you're right, the weekly would be kind of, just a solo per week would also be kind of tough.
And I mean, it's tough to talk about episode 5 without talking about episode 6. So I'm just going to do a brief synopsis of the stars of our destination. With the world in a state of panic following a momentous declaration, Wade gathers the world's greatest minds to prepare a defense plan. I still don't think Will's doing a whole lot. He made a donation, but he's still just pining after Jin. And I still have no idea what Saul is doing. He's really not like this. The Oxford 5 has come down to the Oxford 2. It's Augie and it's Jin. Like, they're the only real players at like here right now, which these two episodes, because of what happens in Panama, Augie is clearly against like helping Wade prevent like to allow our technology to advance so that we are prepared when the Santi arrive 400 years from now, and Jin is more on board, and by the end of it Saul and Will convince her to actually like go and help. So Will and Saul are emotional support. They're emotional support characters. Well, we're going to talk about episode 6, of course, but I do want to say one thing that I've been thinking about in terms of both this show and Shogun, and just the fact that we're watching these two shows simultaneously. Both of them are both based off of books. Both of them are it's large scale storytelling. Granted, both of them are in different genres, and I think they have they have different problems, and they're like mirror images of one another, where Three Body, One Problem, it's a sci-fi show, very conceptual. The characters, though, are flat. The characters there's not a lot of depth. There's not, because you can't do that type of, like, any one of these characters could die, and I'd be like, okay, moving on. Granted, I'm like that about a lot of characters, but still, come on, hear me out.
I'm there with you on that one.
It's still a very watchable show, a very enjoyable show, is because the concept, the ideas, the bigger storyline here, and the mystery of it all. Flip it over to Shogun. I find characters very deep. It's a very character-driven story. We have a lot of them. And so at times, some of them are more shallow than others. But at the end of the day, you're watching Shogun because of these characters and because of the internal conflicts and the politics and all of that. I don't think you're necessarily watching Shogun because of the elaborate story that is like Torinaga rising above and becoming Shogun status. It's a very general story that we've seen 1,000 times play out. It's just the fact that the characters themselves are very compelling and the internal conflicts are very compelling. It's like the reverse of what we're seeing. So taken me a while, but I'm like, okay, now I get why we have like this weird, this nice balance between these two shows, because both of them are good for very different reasons and for opposite reasons. Their strengths and their weaknesses are opposite of one another.
I could not agree more. I mean, you're spot on with that. I can't add anything more to that. I completely agree.
And that's it for us. No.
but you're right. I mean, I was thinking about that today too, with just with as I was putting together my notes for tonight. And the only thing I will add is just like, you know, to your point about they're both off of books. Some of the creative decisions that in the adaptation of these stories, I think took very good stories, and the choices that they've made as far as where they diverge from the source material in many ways has enhanced the story that, you know, which a good adaptation should do. I mean, it should be honored. It should be faithful to the source material, but, you know, sometimes things don't necessarily translate one-to-one from book to live action. So you need to make some dramatic changes to make it work. And I think, I haven't read either one of these books, but from, you know, just hearing other people talk about them on other, you know, podcasts or reading reviews about them, I mean, that definitely is something that I've seen come through.
Right. Yeah. They're adaptations. It's not one for one. And so choices definitely have to be made. So the stars of our destination. So we're going to space.
Yep.
That has been decided. We're going to send a person. Is it going to be Raj? Are they going to send Raj to space, or do you think they're going to send Jen to space?
Well, Raj is definitely getting sent to the moon to lead up the effort. Yeah.
That's a fair. Do you think Jen and Augie are also going to be sent to the moon, or is it just going to be Raj?
I think the team will go to the moon.
Okay. We're going to space.
Yeah, we're going to space. Now, who's going to be on the... Who's going to be on the little starship that gets sent to Desanti to be our, you know, our mole or whatever you want to call her, emissary? Who knows? It could be a character that has yet to be introduced, for all I know.
Yeah. It's going to be Clarence.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's going to be Saul.
We're going to finally make use of Saul. He is the one connected to Vera, just because he's the person who last saw her before she died. Yeah. And so rewind a bit to back when we were saying, like, this last week we had a lot of discussions about Vera, mm-hmm, and her parents, and we got the answers. Her dad biologically is Evans. I still don't, why I said my comment earlier about, like, I don't understand it. I understand that he's the father, like, mm-hmm, okay. I don't understand, like, A, him having never met her before, yet Wenji and him still in constant communications because they're both tied to the Santi.
Yeah.
So, And I get it. Okay, they're not together, but, like, so you just had sex that one time, and, like, you never, like he never saw you pregnant. Like, is that what you're trying to get me to believe? And also, Wenji, come on. Explain to me, why wasn't your kid on the boat? I don't understand that. And then it was also clarified that when Jay did not give Jin Vera's game, like, that was never right. Vera's game. And we were right about that, which makes sense. We were right. That was all a lie. And so Vera, now she saw the correspondence, but what has not been confirmed is if she saw the countdown clock. So she could still, and it's just because I still think it might have been the countdown clock with her, just because of the last thing she says to Saul, like, do you believe in God? And I don't know if correspondence about aliens between her mom and absentee father would, like, spark that so much as actually seeing things. It is interesting how much Vera has a presence in this show,
mm-hmm,
and we barely see her, but she's so connected to everyone.
connected to everyone, and plus all her work is so connected to, again, the overall mission of the Santee to with the Soplan to like keep retard our scientific development, because you know she was she oversaw one of the super colliders, and you know she installs all the wonky things that were happening with it. But yeah, to your point about, I'm still not clear either, to be honest. I mean, I have thoughts as far as why Wenji hid Vera from Evans. You know, was it she? You know, but I just don't. It hasn't been. I haven't seen anything in universe to show what about Evans and his role in all of this with Judgment Day and that Wenji didn't want Vera to be a part of that.
We had a lot of flashbacks with Wenji, and now. Yeah. Like between 87 and present day, it's like, what happened?
Yeah.
But what happened? Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. And so listeners, if you guys have any theories, love to hear from you as far as like, what do you think, why she kept kept Vera away from Evans? Because, you know, as far as like, why did Vera have to die? I mean, to your, you know, as far as the, you know, I do have some thoughts about that, especially something that Wenji said about the, you know, the whole thing with her, with the bugs and.
So why do you think it is? Why did Vera have to die?
So Wenji notes that, you know, in this episode that, you know, she began to see what the Red Brigade in the Cultural Revolution. You know, she could sort of identify with them. You know,
right.
And I think Vera is a lot like her father, you know, who was, you know, who was doing these scientific things to, you know, advance our technology and knowledge of science and stuff, and the cult, you know, of course, whenever we first meet Wenji, whenever she was a kid seeing her father executed there on the lawn, you know, now, you know, now Wenji is the Red Army person who is like seeing the threat, and especially now
humanity. I still don't understand why she has to have her own daughter die.
I guess she sees Vera as like the problem, like, you know, I guess the work that she's doing and stuff is going to keep the advance us to the point where the Santi won't be able to help us, which is right. You know, which he wants, you know, at the end of the day, she sees the Santi as this benevolent race that's going to come here and save us. And Vera is the person who's doing all these great things with science, with all these other scientists around the world, you know, learning this, you know, and
I understand.
Yeah, so I think that's the threat.
Yeah, it goes back to what we were saying before. The scientists are the threat, and that's why they have to die. Wenji should not have raised her to become a scientist.
Yeah, clearly.
I totally understand what you're saying. And, like, in this moment, Wenji, she probably tried to get her to be like, girl, you got to stop this. But it's like, why didn't you raise your daughter to become like a teacher or something else? I don't know. So I still am not fully convinced that Vera had to die. I understand why she did, but considering her whole own mother and absentee father were behind this whole thing, they could have arguably prevented it. But so it's just, I don't know. It's just interesting. I mean, to think about like the decisions, her faith, and yeah, I understand up until the end when Wenji sends another call to her lord and saying that she still has a useful idea or two, like, don't cast me aside. It's like, girl, you're not even going to be alive by the time they get here. What are you doing? and you don't have a legacy anymore because Vera's dead. So, and now you got Jin involved, and Jin made the different choice, and I don't know. So Wenji's very interesting, but she's not Mother of the Year.
No, for sure.
Maybe she knew how Judgment Day would have ended eventually, and that's why she didn't have Vera on the boat to begin with. So I don't know. Anything else you want to say about this episode?
We like I said earlier, we tie it back Will and Jack. I mean, you know, Will gets the Jack's part of his estate. So of course he's got the pancreatic cancer and has months to live. I still, the only thing I can figure, you know, with that storyline with Will, Jack, Jen, and Raj, I guess this is trying to, like, with all these grand scheme things of intergalactic conquering and whatnot, I guess we're trying to, like, humanize it some. To, like, you know, have this love triangle going on with these three characters, or at least attempt at love triangle. But Will's like, nah, you know, he told Augie and Saul, look, let's let her be happy. Is, you know, but I get where they're trying to go with it, but it just feels, again, I bring it up just because I feel like it feels kind of forced into the story and not very organic to all the things that are going on. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. Will's gonna be on the small spaceship.
Yeah.
So I don't know where this show is gonna end. I'm gonna say this now, that this week we're watching the final two episodes to talk about next week. And I have my reservations going into these final two episodes. I don't know if they're going to stick the landing for me.
Yeah.
And I'm very much questioning things.
Yeah. I'm prepared for a cliffhanger because I know, you know, this series is based off of three books. So I think there's only this book one. And, you know, so we got more story to tell. So I'm anticipating a cliffhanger that's going to leave me like, you know, Netflix, you better not cancel this show.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, on that note, Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me on X, but everybody still calls it Twitter, at Will M. Polk, WILLMPOLK.
You can find me there too at SJ Belmont, SJBELMONT. Please follow our crew on Twitter at Scene and Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram and Threads at @Scene_N_Nerd. And visit our website, www.sceneandnerdpodcast.com. But most importantly, rate, follow, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.